And it is a great pleasure to be here in New Zealand once again. I'm doing my best to sound like an Aussie, but I think it's still very much an American accent, so you'll have to get used to that and hope you don't mind it too much. Our theme for this particular weekend is, if I remember correctly, Guidelines for the Spiritual Life. It's really going to be a spiritual journey. It's guidelines for the spiritual journey, we should say. And perhaps the statement I've put on the board, which is from H.P. Blavatsky, from The Secret Doctrine. If you want the exact reference, it's volume 1, page 634. I'd like to, you know, some people like to check up whether I'm really accurate or not, so I give you as far as possible exact references. In one sense, it is this statement, this sentence, that I think provides us with the theme that we are trying to investigate during this weekend. It is the spiritual evolution of the inner immortal man, person, to be, you know, I have to use HPB's language, but today we translate some of these terms into what we call the gender-free language. So it's the inner immortal person that forms the fundamental tenet in the occult sciences. So what we're focused on this weekend is really what is that spiritual journey, that movement which is evolution, that spiritual movement which has to do with the interior nature of our being. So with that in mind, because this is the basic concept which is unique, if I may say, to the theosophical worldview, we now have the ground for our exploration of the spiritual journey. So let me begin then with a story. I love stories, and I think we need to become great storytellers, and I hope that through this weekend you will begin to be some storytellers yourselves. I think to renew the ancient art of storytelling is necessary. We need to tell stories to each other, one kind or another, real stories, all of the great myths. You know, the story of today is science, true, but it's still a story. We think it's fact. Well, what is fact? Well, we'll go into that. Maybe we'll go into it. But the great myth of today, the great story of today is science, isn't it? And everybody says, oh, we've got to really know about science. If we had lived in 15th century Europe, the great story was religion, of course. And we would have all spoken in religious metaphors, Christian metaphors, particularly in 15th century Europe. If we had lived in the Tang Dynasty of China, our metaphors would have been drawn from that culture, and that would have been our story, our myth. So now when we look back, for example, to the 8th century BC and in Greece, and hear the retelling of the Odyssey, for example, that becomes a myth, that becomes a story. But it was that very story, that Homeric, gigantic myth, if you like, that was the fact of an evolutionary journey. So let me start with a story. The story is simply told in 18th century Jewry about the rabbi of White Russia who was jailed for his beliefs. This was during one of the periods of the great pogroms against the Jewish people in White Russia. And he was jailed for his beliefs, and his jailers taunted him. And they said to him, you say your God is all-knowing. He knows everything. Why then did he call into the Garden of Eden, Adam, where art thou? Now, this is on the surface a very logical question for the jailers to ask, you see. You say your God knows everything. He has only two people to look after, and he loses half of humanity. I mean, this is absurd, isn't it? If you can't keep track of two people, how are you going to keep track of everything else that finally develops all humanity? So the jailers go on taunting him. God should have known where Adam was. Obviously, he should have known if he was omnipotent and omniscient and all the things you say. And the rabbi finally answered and said, wait, it is not that God did not know where Adam was. Adam did not know where he was. And so God calls, so the rabbi continued, God calls to man in every age, where are you? Where are you in your journey? Where are you in your life? And this, one can say, is the first instance of psychological shock treatment. A great psychologist was God, you see. And so perhaps that also has to do with what has brought us together in a workshop like this weekend. That we have heard a call, where are you? Where am I in the midst of this? Not just who am I, but where am I in the midst of my life? What am I doing? And what is going on? What is really going on? Not in the world about me. Not in Bosnia, not in Somali, not in all of these trouble places of the world, but in my own psyche, in my own soul, in that inner immortal essence that I call I. What is going on? What is transpiring? And so we are called, as it were, to begin to examine what is this journey that is really the important journey, that is really the essential journey of our whole existence, this incarnation and on to the next. And it's very interesting if you look at that story. Adam did not answer, here I am, O Lord, you see, sort of thing, coming out from behind a tree or wherever he was, you see. What did he answer? He answered in the way that a true, what shall we say, a true individual, authentic individual, authentic to that inner understanding of what had happened to him, answered. He said, I hid myself. It's an interesting phrase, you see. And perhaps many of us do this. And we'll look at this a little bit later this morning, probably after tea. I like to tell you that something's coming after tea so that you come back from your tea, you know. We'll look at this a little bit further because this is rather the beginning of this whole journey. The realization that we have hid ourselves. We have obscured ourselves. We have somehow brought a mask down. And we'll look at that mask in some sense. I hid myself. And that's where, in one sense, we begin. So let us consider, let us back up a little bit. Maybe we can take this down and put up the other one. No, I'm just going to erase this. Does anybody mind if I erase this? And you don't need it anyway. Now and then I start to erase something and people say, oh, I haven't written that down, as though it were some sacred words. Let us consider this in another context, if we can. And that is that with the introduction into the world in the last century of the Theosophical worldview, the founding of the Theosophical Society, which in itself was to embody, by its very title, Theosophical, was to embody a worldview, a view, a way of looking at everything that exists, ourselves included, we can say that three fundamental ideas were introduced into the contemporary world. These are not new ideas. These ideas have always been present from time immemorial, but they were reintroduced. And I'd like to put them in this way. We'll get that open. Because these are the three features, if you want to call it, of the theosophical worldview. I'll just put that. I don't want to have to write out theosophical. I might misspell it on the board. First of all, that there is a wisdom, which means there is a doctrine. There are great ideas which have influenced human thought, that have arisen as part of human thought and been embodied in the great religious systems, in the great philosophies, and have found validation in the lives of many individuals. There is a wisdom. There is a wisdom that is present, that underlies the world. There is a doctrine, that is a teaching that one can come to. And consequently, there are those who know There are those who have experienced that wisdom. Saints, sages, seers, adepts, mahatmas, however you want to call them. There are those who know that wisdom, who not simply possess it. We mustn't think that, because it is not a possession. It is a natural condition of the human being who has taken this journey. It's a natural state into which one enters, a mode of consciousness, a way of knowing, which is, because it is a wisdom, it is not simply knowledge. So the doctrine is not pointing to just an accumulation of facts or ideas, because as I say, what is a fact? We can examine that, you see, in many ways. But it's a wisdom which arises in the knowing of the heart, if you like, an instructiveness of the whole being. It's a wisdom that possesses one which one does not possess. We can put it that way. It arises in the mind, in the consciousness of those who have genuinely sought, inquired, probed, come in their own being to embody the essence of that wisdom. And consequently, since there are those who know, there is a way. A way, a road, a path, a mode of being, however you want to put it, a way that is not a way, by which one can approach those who know and therefore the wisdom itself. There is our concern, therefore, is with the way, the path, the road. And that's what we'll be looking at from many different points of view this weekend. I'll be referring to a number of different metaphors that have been used in this journey, the way in which it has been taken. I think the outline that was given to you indicates that we'll look at some of these images of the spiritual life or the spiritual journey. We'll be looking at them from several different points of view, because there are various ways to look at the way, the path, the road. A way that is no way, a way that is ourselves. You see, what is the way? We're all seekers, but often we don't know what it is that we are seeking. What does it mean, for example, to be a seeker? What does it really mean to be a seeker. Perhaps the word has something to do with seeing. Just seeing. Not in the ordinary physical sense, but with an inner perception. Someone has said that the seeker is humanity's chance to grow. And we must be seekers. The seeker is one with a question, which means you're on a quest. If you have a question, you're on a quest. And since such a person is on a quest, that person is often called a hero. And so we have the great heroic stories like the Odyssey, for example, which is Odysseus is the hero, but Odysseus is in each one of us. If we have time, we may explore that, you see. So is Dante in each one of us, in his journey. And so are many others that we'll look at. Lucius Apuleius, which is what happens to be one of my favorites. And I hope we have time to look at, well, I'll just make time because it's important, you see, when it's my favorite. We have to. We can look at this also from the point of view that this path, this road, this way, however you want to phrase it, is simply another way of defining our own orientated becoming. The path is your orientated becoming. It's your, that is to say, you orientate yourself in a certain direction. You find what is that direction, and then move in that direction. We can look at this from yet another point of view. What did I do with that today? We might as well keep this. I don't mind erasing and putting things up. It's very easy. We can look at this in yet another way, if you like. That in our experiences through life, we can move through what I like to call, and what others have called, three realms of experience. There is, first of all, the historical realm, which we can call the factual realm. Again, we come back. I'm not going to go into what is a fact. You can begin to explore that. But it's the realm of the historical. If I ask you to tell the story of your life, you see, you probably begin, I was born. Well, of course you were. I mean, you wouldn't be here if you hadn't been born, you know, and you go through, I went to this school and I went to that and I married so-and-so and I got divorced. Oh no, you didn't get divorced, you stayed with that person. And you know, and you had these many children and this happened and that happened. And all of this, isn't that right, you see? And that becomes the history. And you think that's the story of your life. Isn't that right? If I ask you to tell the story of your life, that's the way most of us begin. And we go through, you know, however many years, and it becomes a linear movement, doesn't it? From birth to wherever you are now, you see. But there is also a realm of experience on this road. That's one path. That's one path. That's one aspect of the path, of course, one aspect of the way. Is the story of an incarnation from the beginning to wherever you now are now. That's the story, you say, of this incarnation, and so on. But there is another realm of experience that I think we have to look at, because if you really go deeper, your story has to do with the mythic and symbolic realm of experience. The mythic and symbolic realm of experience. Think again of the story of your life. Think again of the story of your life. And think of it in terms not of the physical outer experiences, not of those events, but of what they did to you, how they transformed you, how you changed as a result of it. Do you see? What happened to you? For some of us, for example, when we came upon the Theosophical Society, what did we say? Or we came upon the ideas of theosophy. What did we say? Aha! There it is. That gives me some answers. Well, it doesn't. It ought to. It shouldn't. Theosophy should not give you any answers. It should raise more questions. That's why I say, some of you, I guess, may not be members of the society. Be careful if you ever decide to join. You know, I like to issue a few warnings. I don't know whether the members here in New Zealand issue warnings, so I'm issuing them for you, you see. Because I'll tell you something, theosophy becomes the worst virus you can catch. It never leaves you. It's like a virus. It is a virus of the inner being. And it keeps, sort of spreading. And it gets into the very blood and fiber and bone of your being, And it takes over. And it takes over all of your being, your consciousness. This is, threatening, isn't it? Because what are the boundaries of consciousness? What are the boundaries of consciousness? Do we know? You see? We keep pushing against them, and that's what theosophy really does. So if you look at your life then, what are the great turning points? What are those great moments which now can be put in mythic terms? Because myth is not fancy. Myth is not fiction. Myth is the true history of the soul. It's the true history of the psyche. And that's why we can look at all the great myths, like the Odyssey, for example. The great myths, the Greek myths and the Indian myths and the myths of every culture and the myth of science today, because science is a myth. It's not that it's not true, you see. But it's the myth that has taken us up. It's the myth that provides us the metaphor of our lives today, as religion did, as I say, in the 15th century, and so on. And what heaven only knows what the myth of the next century is going to be. 100 years from now, 200 years from now, you see. What's going to happen? It's very interesting if you look back to the establishment, as it were, of Western science with Newton. Newton was not simply a scientist, remember. He was a great religionist. He was firmly grounded in a religious point of view. I think you have to look at Newton's life to realize that it was within that context, so to speak, that he began to probe further and further and develop certain laws which apply, still apply, but have been, in one sense, expanded and developed in new ways into now what we call quantum physics and all of that. I better not get into that because I'm not a physicist, but it's interesting to see how it has moved. And many people say Newton is obsolete because Einstein took his place, and Einstein is now obsolete because others have come along, like Bohm and Paul Davies and some of the great scientists on the frontiers of science today who say that certain things that Einstein said were false were wrong. And Einstein said Newton didn't have the whole answer, of course not, and so on. So look at your own life again and begin to tell your story from the point of view of those experiences that are the genuine transformations of the soul. These are the mythic dimensions of your life. They are the symbolic dimensions, do you see? If I were to ask each of you to draw a symbol that you thought of as your symbol, that really symbolizes you, you see, I think we need to expand into new modes of thinking. In fact, that is one of the primary, shall I say, one of the primary motives in the representation of this ageless wisdom, which we now call theosophy, by H.P. Blavatsky. In fact, she points to seven modes of thinking. Seven modes of thinking, and one of which is the symbolic and allegorical. And whether we know it or not, we think in symbols, which is another word for metaphors in one sense, you see. We think in metaphors. And it's very interesting how we draw our metaphors from nature even, and from the past. We can go into that if there's time. So this is the realm of genuine experience. Now we're approaching the real realm of our experience, not the historical, but the mythic and symbolic realm of experience. This is the realm of experience of the soul. And we have to move, I think, to then what I can only call the realm of the unitive. The realm of what we can call the source level of our being. If you like, I'm going to use red regardless of how it turns out on the screen because I think this is important. This is the physical, you see. That's the physical realm, the historical realm. Physical etheric, if you want. I don't care how you put it. This mythic, symbolic realm is the realm, and I'll put it in quotes, of the soul, the realm of the psyche. And I want to use that word not in terms of some psychic phenomena, because psyche is a very precious word. Psyche has to do with that interior nature of our being, that troublesome area of the soul, so to speak, as somebody has called it. I don't know quite where to put it. But the psyche has to do with that growing point of consciousness within us. If you like, some people probably prefer some of this, you know, the traditional theosophical terms. So, all right, this is the realm of come among us. If you like, some people probably prefer some of this, you know, the traditional theosophical terms. So, all right, this is the realm of come among us. That may satisfy some theosophists more. It's really the realm of manas, whether it's associated with kama or with buddhi. It participates a bit in buddhi. Of course, it has to with the realm of what we usually translate as intuition, which is an awful word because it means anything you wish it to mean, intuition. You know, it's almost anything you wish it to be, rather than really being that realm of illumination, of light, because that it's the realm where you come awake. That's what buddhi really means, buddhi, to come awake, to really come awake. The light goes on, as it were, and I'm awake. That's what it is, which is wisdom, discriminative wisdom, if you like. So this is the realm where we really have to begin to examine the journey, there is the realm of experience where the journey, the true journey, takes place. The unity, of course, is the realm of spirit, if you like. The realm of the universal. The realm in which we are all rooted. The realm in which there is but one. And so our journey in that sense, our journey is simply through the physical in that manner. Do you see? That is, these are the three realms of genuine experience. And what is the journey of the spirit? If you want that in other terms, it's the journey then of the monad. The pilgrim soul, as H.P. Blavatsky termed the monad. The monad is the pilgrim, you see. Now, you might like this, let us say, in more theosophical terminology. So let's look at a little diagram that I've come to find is meaningful to me. You won't find it anywhere else. It's Joy Mill's diagram. You can use it if you like. I haven't published it yet. There's no copyright on it. So I don't care if anybody takes it. They can have it. And you may like it and you may not like it. It's all right with me. Now, there are various modes, therefore. Am I moving too far away? Good. You know, my philosophy, you see, I was trained as a teacher, and I was always taught if you kept moving, it's harder to hit a moving object. So now and then I don't sit, I keep moving, you know, so that anybody throws anything. Incidentally, if anyone wants to interrupt me at any time with a question, for heaven's sakes, do. I'm likely to get to talking and forget that you might be thinking, why doesn't she stop and pause for a drink of water? Take a breath so I can ask a question. So, are there any questions? Good. No. I have in some of my notebooks at home this wonderful cartoon of the lecturer, you know, who after the lecture said, are there any questions? And he pulled out a gun and I don't mind questions, because, you know, you can ask whatever you want because I don't guarantee to answer anything. But that you'll find out. But somebody asked me one time, what do you think about, or do you think about this? And I said, look, I think about anything. But anyhow, I have opinions on everything. There are many ways, there are modes of travel. Let us put it this way, modes of travel on this journey. So we've talked about that first realm, which starts with birth and presumably moves along. We can only picture it in a linear way because it is a linear space-time movement to, can't even make a Z here. I'm learning to say Z instead of Z. Isn't that wonderful? In the United States, we say Z, but I've learned to say Z. Isn't that marvelous? This is a great triumph. There we are. So this point that, you know, where is it? Well, and so this is through space-time. And the mode of travel there is what has been called transmigration. Everybody's going to, theosophists don't believe in transmigration. Well, I don't care whether you believe in it or not, it happens. Isn't that something? It's going on all the time. For those of you who want to delve into it, HPB, and that's H.P. Blavatsky for those who may not be familiar with her, HPB wrote a marvelous article called The Transmigration of Life Atoms. And this is going on all the time. You realize that we're sitting in each other's soup, protoplasmic soup. Yeah. Isn't that right? And we're all the time in exchange. This is one of the fundamental principles of the Hindu philosophy, as presented very beautifully in the Bhagavad Gita. There is always an exchange. Yajna, it's called in Sanskrit, if you want. I can throw in some terms now and that make you think I know something about it. So this is going on all the time. The structure of your very physical being is undergoing constant change, isn't it? This is transmigration, because no matter is ever lost in the universe, is it? Is anything ever lost? It changes all the time. And this is transmigration. Plato knew this, of course. So did Plotinus, the Neoplatonists, and so on. And certainly the Upanishadic authors knew this in the East. It's a very well-known fact. Chinese philosophy knew it all the time. An exchange is all the time going on. You cannot leave here today in the same bodies in which you came in. It's not that I'm going to keep you forever. It's just the very fact that there is all the time a transmigratory process, transmigration going on. Are you the same individual wherever you are on this line? You see, I've lived about that many years. I figure about that much left, you know. I don't know, but I'm figuring on, you know, I may not be that much left, but I'm sort of figuring on that. You may be somewhere else down here, you know, and figure on a whole lot more. But anyway, I'm about there. That's about right, you know. I give myself another, I don't know, maybe 20 years, who knows. So anyhow, we'll see. Are you the same being that you were 20 years ago? Ooh, no. Am I the same one that left Crotona early in January? Australia has already widened me. I don't know whether it's deepened me, but it has widened me. Physically. So this is constantly going on. Continually going on. But there is another movement. There is another movement which we can see in this direction. Because this is the physical etheric, if you like. We'll call it that. That's the easiest way to call it in theosophical terminology. It's the sthula sharira, the densest vehicle, with the linga, the model body, the kind of that envelope in which sensation is really rooted. But there is another dimension which is brought about by an energy which in theosophical terminology is called kama, desire, passion, a movement that thrusts us in another direction, that awakens us, which comes somewhere in the middle of this, you see. Dr. Carl Jung recognized this from the psychological point of view. And he put it that from his empirical observations, from his studies and so on, he noticed that around the age of 35 came a transition in consciousness from moving out and being concerned with the world and being concerned with things to now a movement inward, a kind of what he called, following in the old Greek pattern, a movement that is known as anantodromia, that is a movement that now brings about a return. And in every hero journey, there are these two movements, basically. There's a movement outward and a movement inward. And then there is a third that is a movement outward again, but with a new appearance, so to speak, a new understanding, a new being is born. So it is this that suddenly desire, passion, that moves us into a new level. which we can call the nice term from the Sanskrit, manas. The whole realm of consciousness of the mind. A lot of people, you know, denigrate the mind. Say, oh, we have to get rid of the mind, and the mind is the slayer of the real, and heaven only knows what all. Stupid, you know. Go on and read the rest of the Voice of the Silence. People get stuck with that second verse, the mind is the slayer of the real, and they stop there, and hooray, I'm going to slay the mind. What are you going to slay the mind with? You know. You know, you're fighting windmills like Don Quixote, sort of thing. What do you do with the mind? Of course it slays the real, because only by, shall we say, dividing up the real, dismembering the real, do we come to that remembering of the real. Only the dismemberment of Osiris could bring about the initiation of the remembrance of Osiris, or Dionysius, or Prajapati in the Hindu tradition. All of these great myths point to the same thing. So manas is this marvelous field rooted in universal mind, universal consciousness, universal mind, replete with the archetypes, replete with the great ideas which can be contacted, can be touched, and then focused through the individual mind, which uses a brain consciousness here. And so this movement here, as this is, better use another color here, as this movement is transmigration, this movement, so this movement between manas, from manas through kama to the physical, is reincarnation. I'm making it very difficult for those that are trying to film this, but I hope you can see it. This is the movement, then, of reincarnation. A cyclic and periodic movement, do you see? But there is another movement, an extremely important movement at this level, which we can call metempsychosis. Don't often speak of this. Metempsychosis, if I spelled it correctly, yes. Which takes place at this level. And for this, I refer you again to H.P. Blavatsky. In the third fundamental proposition in the Secret Doctrine, she makes a magnificent statement that I think should make us all pause and think, what does it mean? And why has she put it this way? She states, the pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy, and that ought to waken us up, the pivotal doctrine means the doctrine which is really central, moves on the pivot, you see. The central doctrine, pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy teaches that there are no special gifts in man, in the human being, save those won by his own ego, and this is the seat of the ego, if you like, the seat of the soul, the seat of the psyche, save those won by his own ego, by personal effort and merit, throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnations. Now, why does she put metempsychoses first? Because it's not just attaining something throughout this linear progression of incarnation after incarnation, and suddenly one is awake. You know, it's like becoming a bigger and bigger caterpillar and never moving into another development, you see, and that's the metaphor that's often used. It's been the metaphor for centuries, is the metaphor of the transformation of the caterpillar into a being, a totally new being, of the butterfly. Completely new being. And this is metempsychosis, a complete change of the psychic structure. And that's why I like the term psyche, in its true sense, as the soul, the center of consciousness, manas, in its fullness, you see. So this is the pivotal doctrine, is that we win our own immortality. There are no special gifts, save those which we have won throughout a long series of metempsychoses. And all of the great myths of the world point to the essential nature of the metempsychosis. This is where the journey is taken. Remember the statement I had up there, the spiritual evolution of the inner immortal individual that forms the fundamental tenet. Do you see? And so this must take place. This is the real journey. Here is simply the historical, you see. People who get wrapped up in what were my past lives and so on, and going through all this nonsense of rebirthing, and I think it's nonsense anyway, are failing to recognize what is the essential nature that needs transformation. This is the seat of transformation. And so from that, then, one springs upwards, as it were, through the awakening of that great principle of buddhi. As I say so often, simply translated, it's an energy. It's an energy which is the counterpart of kama. They are the same energy, but in one sense, one is the counterpart of the other. They are really essentially the same, derived from the same source. But what is this? It's illumination from within. It's that interior awakening that is sustained, because the word Buddha simply means to come awake, to come fully awake. The mind is clear, no obstructions, none of the filters of personal desire, none of the filters and obstructions and obstacles of a personal self, but to be fully in its own nature, fully in its own being, you see. And B is to nurture or sustain. We have it in the word dharma, for example, it's the same root, the in Sanskrit, to nurture, to sustain that wakefulness. Most of us go through life like sleepwalkers. We're not aware of it, we think we're awake, but we bump into the furniture of the world. And we say that's an experience, you know, because I bumped into the furniture of the world, I bumped into you, and, you know, and so on. This is what we think of as experience. But this is to nurture that wakefulness in which the mind is now established, and therefore brought down. And what happens there? This is the process that is spoken of in the biblical, in St. Paul, by St. Paul, who was a great initiate, of course, as metanoia. Meta, you see, like metem, it's the same Greek verb, there it's metem, meta, above, a new mind, a new being, a new consciousness, metanoia. This is what St. Paul wrote about in his epistle to the Romans. Except ye be converted in your mind. This is a further stage, do you see? Here is the real movement now, from the change of the psyche to now a totally new consciousness. This is why in the great correspondence which we have between two of those individuals known as Mahatmas, who had come further on the way towards the wisdom, towards knowing the wisdom, in their correspondence with one of the early members of the society, A.P. Sinnott, they pointed out that there had to be that illumination from within. And they said, come out of your world into ours. Because their world is a totally new consciousness. We can't even imagine it. Because what do we think of as consciousness is just an extension of our present consciousness. But this is a totally new consciousness. That is what is to be brought about. In one sense, that's the whole purpose of the Theosophical Society, as I see it at least, is to instill in the human being this movement towards a totally new consciousness, a totally new mind. Incredible. We can't even imagine it until you're there. And then you say, ah, this is it, you see. And so, the final, again, I have to picture it this way, as I say, my own diagram, not patented, not copyrighted, and so on, but I've come to feel that it contains a great deal. That one then moves to that universal all, if you like, of Atman, which through an individual point comes down, moves down through this, and at that stage, then, the only word that one can use, I've tried different words, it's no longer a process, it's a state of being which is full enlightenment. Complete and whole enlightenment. This is the condition of the Buddha. This is indeed that state in which the Buddha rests, but moves from that condition to bless all humanity. This is that Christ consciousness raised to its fullest degree, in which the very presence of such an individual, the very presence of such a consciousness, elevates all life, all beings, is a blessing to the whole world. Now that's the journey. We can get stuck in just the historical transmigration. We can get stuck there, that I've lived a certain number of years, I've done a certain number of things, been president of the American section, been vice president, president of Australia. You know, this is historical. So what? So what? It's a nice history, you know. One reason I thought it'd be fun to do this in Australia is because up to that time I'd been introduced as she did this and did that, and I sounded like a has-been. And so, so I thought it'd be fun to do something when I can say she is something, you see. Anyway, you can live your whole life that way. Or you can awaken to the fact that there is a cyclic journey, which we call reincarnation, and you get stuck there, you see. Now, if you begin to look at this, you see why Krishnamurti, when he was asked about reincarnation, you know, made that very, very paradoxical statement. Reincarnation is a fact, but it's not the truth. Of course not, because you've left out the whole top of it, do you see? A lot of people get all hung up on Krishnaji's statement about that. Well, you can get caught up in all that cyclic sort of business, you know, of reincarnation. But the center of our journey that we'll be talking about is here. The metempsychosis to which HPB pointed, which we can lead to a metanoia, which can thrust us upward. It's like each one of us possesses an interior rocket thrust that shoves us up, and it's now time to shove you off to tea.